This is Mind Shock. I am your host, Bruce McGuire.
Maxwell Powers.
And Johnny Mills.
Today's episode, we are going over the Bigfoot conspiracy. Is there an active U.S. government cover-up of Sasquatch?
Sasquatchy.
If you like the podcast, make sure you subscribe and also click the bell to get notifications.
So that you can be updated on when we upload our new podcast.
And we got quite a few series going now, Bigfoot being one of them. So what do you guys think? Is one of the reasons Bigfoot hasn't been publicly accepted by scientific community and mainstream, is it because there's an active U.S. government cover-up, kind of like with UFOs?
UFOs are real?
Like controlling the media and stuff to
everything, just an active cover-up, silent, like Men in Black for UFOs. What if there's, you know, forestry version, the Forestry Service version of the Men in Black? You didn't see a Sasquatch, you didn't see a Bigfoot, that was just a bear. Now get lost. I mean, there's stories of Bigfoot researchers getting like their car ransacked and getting asked questions when they're like in the woods looking for Bigfoot. So there's definitely a little bit of that going on. But how much tinfoil we got today?
Got a couple rolls.
All right. Yeah. So quite a bit of research went into this. So I'm going to be looking at historical sources where the U.S. government might have actually possibly admitted Bigfoot was real before the conspiracy of silence. Very interesting. So from articles from various blogs and other sources. So there was So here's an actual page from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and this is the Environmental Atlas for Washington.
What year?
State. 1975. So this, if you guys want to look at it, this is an actual page from this atlas published by these engineers.
So they drew this thing up.
Well, also the locations of it. So they're
British
treating
Columbia.
For the purpose of this atlas, it's being referred to as a real creature, unless it's some kind of
that's awesome.
Unless it's some kind of a hoax where the whole atlas is legit except for that one page, and they're just making fun of people. But in 1975, also, like, attitudes towards a lot of this was a bit different as well.
That's interesting. It's not even like a myth or.
Well, once again, this is the Environmental Atlas for Washington State, published by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers,
and it's there to tell people, like, look out for these things. Watch out, you might get killed.
I'm not sure. It just says, yeah, it says reports of Sasquatch tracks and sightings. So it's kind of interesting.
Because, like, usually they have, like, bear things, right? Or, like, look out for bears or coyotes or wolves.
And that's not the only – this isn't the only reference to Bigfoot or Sasquatch by the U.S. government or the military. So let's look at this. July 1975, Washington Star News report. Though conceding that his existence is hotly disputed, the Army Corps of Engineers has officially recognized Sasquatch, the elusive and supposedly legendary creature of the Pacific Northwest Mountains. Also known as Bigfoot, Sasquatch is described in the just-published Washington Environmental Atlas as standing as tall as 12 feet and weighing as much as half a ton, covered with long hair except for face and hands, having a distinctive human-like form. The atlas, which cost $200,000 to put out, and this was in 1975, so it's a lot more money now, offers a map pinpointing all known reports of Sasquatch sightings and notes that a sample of reputed Sasquatch hair was analyzed by the FBI and found to belong to no known animal. The last piece of information that concerning analysis of hair led to the investigation by Peter Byrne of the Bigfoot Research Project in Mount Hood, Oregon. Byrne wrote to the FBI stating, "Will you kindly, to set the record straight, once and for all, inform us if the FBI has examined hair which might be that of a Bigfoot when this took place? If it did take place, what the results of the analysis were?" The FBI replied to Byrne's request as follows. Since the publication of the Washington Environmental Atlas in 1975, which referred to such examinations, we have received several inquiries similar to yours. However, we have been unable to locate any references to such examinations in our files. Does that mean they're classified? The FBI did, however, follow up with a Dr. Stephen Rice, who was the editor of the Army Atlas. In an official report, the FBI states, after checking, Dr. Rice was unable to locate his source of the reported FBI hair examination. So if this was a cover-up, did they just silence it and get rid of the evidence? We don't know. The Army Atlas and other information relative to the FBI was obtained by Jody Cook under the Freedom of Information Privacy Act. Jody wrote to the FBI and requested all information relative to Bigfoot. He received documentation, and it appears there's always a little mystery whenever the FBI is involved in anything. Attached to the file sent to Jody Cook was a standard pre-printed Dear Requester form. Curiously, a box on this form which states "See additional information" which follows is checked. At the bottom of the form, the following information was manually typed in. Enclosed are previously processed documents which relate to Bigfoot. The enclosed are the best copies available. Serial 4 is missing from the file 95-213013, the file where your release originates. Our effort to locate that document was not successful. It is possible that the number 4 was missed during the original serialization of the file. So what was in serial 4? Will we ever know for sure? Certainly the FBI will be a little bit more efficient in their filing procedures to omit this section. We have, however, learned that analysis of hair samples, as indicated in the Washington Star News article, definitely took place. George Clappison did extensive research on this incident and was referred by the FBI to the ex-head of their hair and fiber unit. This person, who now runs his own private laboratory out of his home, was in charge at the time the hair samples were submitted to the FBI. He told Clappison that the analysis was done after hours on employees' own time. He further stated that no written reports were prepared on the analysis. In discussing the whole situation with the current head of the FBI Hair and Fiber Unit, Clappison asked if the unit would now consider analyzing other hair samples. The current manager agreed to perform an analysis, however, he informed the unit would not respond in writings on their findings. So he's preempting right off the bat, we'll test it, but we won't give you any paperwork about it. Mm-hmm. Is that weird or no?
Yeah.
Back to the Washington Atlas. In the Washington Atlas, it describes Bigfoot as being a very large animal, 8 to 10 feet tall, weighing up to 1,000 pounds, with feet measuring up to 24 inches long. The width of the footprint is up to 10 inches wide. More departments confirmed. So here's a release from the Department of the Interior Fish and Wildlife Service. News release December 21st, 1977. Keith Schreiner is Associate Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The service is the government agency with responsibility for protecting endangered and threatened species. The key law in preservations of a species is the Endangered Species Act, which pledges the United States to conserve species of plants and animals facing extinction. This broad, complex law protects endangered species from killing, harassment, and other forms of exploitation. The act prohibits the import and export of and interstate commerce in endangered species. American citizens cannot engage in commercial traffic in endangered species between nations, even when the U.S. is not involved. Scientists wishing to study endangered species are required to have a permit issued by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Schreiner acknowledged, however, that a good deal of international cooperation would be needed if extremely rare species were found abroad, and finding one on U.S. soil would pose serious problems, too. The key law in preservations of a species is the Endangered Species Act, but before a creature can receive protection under the Endangered Species Act, a number of actions normally must occur which involved recommendations from the public, scientists, and state and foreign governments where the species exists. The first of these would be the species' formal description and naming in a recognized scientific publication. In addition, if it were a U.S. species, the governor of the state where it was found would be contacted, as would the officials of foreign governments if it was found outside the United States. Only after much information was collected could the service make a formal determination as to whether the species should be afforded endangered or threatened status. For the Loch Ness Monster, the first step has already been taken. Last year, a highly respected British journal published a description and proposed the name Nesseteris rhombopteryx, meaning awesome monster of Loch Ness with a diamond-shaped fin. Bigfoot, also known as Sasquatch, is reported to be an 8-foot, 900-pound humanoid that roams the forest and wilderness areas of the Pacific Northwest. One eyewitness described an obviously female Sasquatch as a tall, long-legged, gorilla-like animal covered with dark hair and endowed with a pendulous pair of breasts. It, too, has been described in publications and given a scientific name. In fact, so many people were stalking Bigfoot with high-powered rifles and cameras that Skamania County, Washington, is prepared to impose a fine of $10,000 and a 5-year jail term on anyone who kills a Bigfoot. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers even lists Bigfoot as one of their native species in its environmental atlas for Washington. That's what we just looked at. This year, the Florida and Oregon legislatures also considered bills protecting Bigfoot-type creatures. A Bureau of Indian Affairs policeman has 18-inch plaster-cast footprints of the McLaughlin Monster, a Bigfoot-type creature he saw last month in South Dakota. Under U.S. law, the Secretary of the Interior is empowered to list as threatened or endangered a species for 120 days on an emergency basis. For endangered species in the United States, the secretary can also designate habitat that is critical to their survival. No federal agency could then authorize, fund, or carry out any activities which would adversely modify that habitat. So long-term federal protection of Nessie or Bigfoot would basically be a matter of following the same regulatory mechanisms already used in protecting whooping cranes and tigers. So now the question becomes, are there any record of the military encountering a Bigfoot? And the answer is yes.
Ooh.
Are you ready, Maxwell? Fort Stewart, Savannah, Georgia. In December 1995, a sergeant known only as RB was training in a remote area with two other infantry squad leaders and two privates. Their assignment was to reconnoitre another unit located several miles distant. To avoid detection in the growing darkness, the men waded into chest-deep swamp water for several hundred yards, guided by a map and a compass. After leaving the swamp, Sergeant RB noticed that for the next 15 minutes, a shadow would approach to within 25 yards of the team, but just when they expected to catch sight of their unidentified pursuer, it would break off. In an effort to elude whatever was trailing them, Sergeant RB, another sergeant, and a private halted while the other two men continued. 5 minutes later, the other soldiers followed, but the mystery creature was not fooled. Sergeant RB wrote, "We could hear something or someone following us. It would go around us, fade off, and then we would hear it coming again. It started weaving in and out of the two groups like a figure eight. It came between the two groups, around them, toward us, like it knew exactly where we were, even though we couldn't see it. When the reunited team was 400 meters from the opposing unit, they established a patrol base. Sergeant RB and another sergeant would reconnoitre their objective and then return in 2 hours when a second pair would start out. After covering 200 meters, the men heard their nemesis again. They crossed an open area, then fell to the ground watching their rear. After 5 minutes, they heard a scream roar. Sergeant RB recorded, "This is when it got really weird. A minute later, it screamed again, and then we heard what sounded like a huge rotten tree falling and brush breaking. That was the last we heard and the last I wanted to hear." A second encounter. The second notable encounter occurred at 2 a.m. on November 12, 1998. Barry was a gunner on an armored tracked vehicle that was maneuvering on dirt tank trails in the swampy northeast portion of Fort Stewart. Barry was scanning for simulated targets through a thermal sight while the driver was driving using a night vision device. At one intersection, Barry scanned the track and observed something come out of the vegetation. 50 yards away, entering the brush on the opposite side, it crossed the 15 to 20 foot wide lane in three easy strides. The creature ignored the approaching tank, keeping its head and torso looking straight ahead. Barry, who had trained with night vision equipment, estimated the creature's height to be 8 feet tall. He also concluded that this hairy entity was unclothed due to the fact that it appeared through the thermal sight to be one constant color from head to foot. Barry had watched documentaries and read books about Bigfoot as a kid, and he immediately thought this was one. Through the Bradley's internal communication system, he reported the sightings, but the spooked commander ordered the driver to punch it, and the vehicle quickly exited the vehicle.
He punched the Sasquatch?
And the vehicle quickly exited the area. I guess punch it as in the gas pedal.
Oh.
Barry's story swiftly spread through the camp, with soldiers taking some heavy ribbing over seeing Bigfoot. Later, another soldier approached and confided that his father, while stationed at Fort Stewart in the 1960s, had seen an identical unclassified animal in that area. Other encounters. There was a more recent report at Fort Lewis Army Base in August 19th, 2008. The report was from Jeffrey Fullerton. Fort Lewis, Washington, May 1984. I was a sergeant of military police at the time of the incident, stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. I went to investigate a report of a disturbance within the tree line near the post stockade. This was early May 1984, approximately 0300 to 0400 hours. The bars had closed shortly before the call. The MPDO heard strange cries from within the forest and wanted it checked out. I went in one direction while the canine unit went in another to sweep the area. We planned to meet up again at an old railroad spur, not too far into the trees. I saw nothing nor heard a sound until the canine apparently made contact with something. Then I heard five distinct pistol shots, at which I heard a deep guttural growl building into an extremely high-pitched howling. I've never heard anything like that. And the sounds of something large crashing through the thick brush and foliage in the area. Important to note that I was too young and gung-ho, i.e. stupid, to be scared. I was armed with my issue 45 and 12-gauge riot gun and continued to the rendezvous point, hearing nothing further. At the spur, short of sunken with high berms, I went up to the far side and halted at the edge of a large meadow. The captain was already there at the rendezvous, having not seen anything either. Neither of us knew what the canine unit had fled the forest on the trail of the dog. We were about to head back when I caught movement in the adjacent tree line off to my left. I could plainly see a large dark shape mocking along the southeast edge of the meadow, but within the tree line. Mount Rainier was southeast of my location and was the direction of movement. It appeared to be a bear. I held my weapon at the ready. When the object turned and came out and into the meadow, it was approximately 35 yards from our position, moving from left to right. It did not register at first, as I nearly pulled the trigger, but something didn't look right. Bears walk on all fours. This bear was clearly walking on two legs. It was getting on towards morning as false dawn was in evidence. I could see well enough, but not as to clearly make out facial features. All I can figure is the wind must have shifted, for the creature stopped and turned its head and looked directly at me. It turned its whole body and just stood there looking at us, arms by its sides. The creature was not threatening us at all, so I lowered my weapon and did not open fire. I remember the head moving slightly from side to side. It did not move closer, and neither did we. We stared at each other for less than 2 to 3 minutes, maybe less. Ultimately, it resumed its original direction and walked away, looking back once, but kept going, disappearing into the opposite tree line. The animal was covered with short dark hair, massive arms and shoulders, probably 7.5 to 8 feet tall. The neck was not evident. The head, bullet-shaped. The face appeared ape-like, though due to poor light conditions, I could not see facial features clearly, but I can say that it definitely was not Elvis nor the Pillsbury Doughboy. I estimate the weight at close to 500 pounds, as the tracks we later found would attest. I estimated the size by comparison. My son likes WWF wrestling, and I met Andre the Giant and shook his hand. If he is really 7'4", then this creature was taller, yet as I am 6'5", and recall the size difference between Andre, the giant wrestler, and me. At the time, it was said we were either drunk, crazy, or on drugs, as I recall the harassment I had to endure. I can't imagine a person so bored with life or in need of attention to purposely set himself to look like a fool. I'll tell you now, no official report was ever made. I valued my army career more than a few moments of limelight. As I said, I saw an ape-like creature. I never said I saw a Bigfoot, nor had a donut with a Sasquatch. But I'm 43 now, retired military. I can't prove any of this. All I can tell you is I know what I saw. It no longer matters who believes me or if nobody does. Back in 1993, I went to Caro, Michigan, to the Michigan-Canadian Bigfoot Center, Wayne King's home. I told him of my incident. He played an audio cassette of a supposed Bigfoot for me. The scream was exactly as the one I heard so long ago. I must say further that the creature I saw did not appear to act as though it had recently been shot at. So what do we think of these military encounters?
That's cool. I like that one.
Do they hold more weight than civilian encounters or a random hiker? Or that lady writing a book who spotted Bigfoot and Dogman together?
He had the shield and the sword.
little trinkets. Well, to me, it holds a little bit more weight just because there's a lot more risk to...
come forward?
Yeah. Like the way he said, it wasn't worth it to him to share till later.
Well, he shared it, I guess, with the...
few friends or something.
With the soldiers there, and they all made fun of him. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I found this PDF, or this book that is in PDF format from the army.mil website. All right, so Shaping Environmental Awareness, the United States Army Corps of Engineers Environmental Advisory Board, 1970 to 1980. If you do a quick little Control-F and search Sasquatch, we get a... reference. So it says, Seattle District updated and edited the provisional Washington State inventory with the support of the Institute for Environmental Studies of the University of Washington. Then it was published by the government printing office in January 1975 as the Washington Environmental Atlas, like you're talking about. This handsome publication received wide acclaim. One item which distinguished it was the mention of Sasquatch or Bigfoot, who, if not mythical, was certainly an endangered species.
Huh.
Endangered species.
Were people killing them that? There's a crazy conspiracy theory that the U.S. government actually wiped them all out, except for a couple that survived, and that's what people are seeing. That is, if it's not an interdimensional traveler of sorts like Maxwell believes. Is that what you believe, Maxwell?
Nah.
You don't think it's an interdimensional traveler?
Know
I don't understand it well enough, that phenomena, so I
know what their favorite song would be. It's by Beastie Boys, Intergalactic. Intergalactic Planetary. You know that song?
No. Oh, I remember that.
Planetary.
That was by Beastie Boys?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Can I put it on? It's the Bigfoot theme song.
The only song I know by the Beastie Boys are No Sleep Till Brooklyn.
Yeah,
and
Part... Wait, is that the same song? Party?
No. What's the party song? All right, let's look at the next encounter. This is an Oregon encounter. Todd Nace of Oregon was witness to three Bigfoot in 1933 in Oregon while on military duty. Todd was a sergeant in Charlie Company, 1249th Combat Engineers, and while training on a mission of combat engineering, witnessed three Sasquatch. He said this, "In the middle stood what I assumed to be the alpha male of the group, as it towered a full head above the two creatures that flanked it. I would estimate it to have stood approximately 9 feet high, with the flanking creatures approaching 7 feet in height. There are many more stories about the military and Sasquatch running into each other, but I'll stop with the stories for now." All right, so that not much of that encounter, but... So a lot of reports from Washington, Oregon, Georgia, where military personnel or other government agencies have already accepted that Bigfoot is a real creature.
Were you able to get an actual copy of that book, the Atlas?
The full book? No.
I was trying to get a copy of it online, but I can't find it. There's no preview, but it looks like it's definitely...
All right, well, here is a very interesting newspaper article from 1975.
About the Atlas.
Check it out. Here's the title. Elusive Bigfoot gets official recognition by U.S. Army.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
That's just referencing that 1975 Atlas. But this is an actual article that was released as well. So here's the article. I'll just read a piece of it. The U.S. Army has officially recognized Bigfoot, the legendary ape-like creature that stalks the wilds of the Pacific Northeast and Russia. The recognition, first ever by a U.S. government agency, came in the latest environmental atlas published by the Army Corps of Engineers, which devotes an entire page to the mysterious creature. Bigfoot was included in the Washington Environmental Atlas because, quote, there is so much overwhelming evidence that points to such a creature, end quote, explained Jean McManus, who was editor of the reference work. Quote, the details about the creature were gathered from many sources, anthropologists, writers, and genuine Bigfoot hunters. A great deal of time and effort has gone into hunting this creature, and it seemed only right to include it in the book. End quote. The Atlas also reveals that the FBI conducted extensive laboratory tests on hair believed to have come from the Bigfoot. The Bigfoot concluded that the hair was not from any human or from any known animal form, the official Army volume said. The FBI headquarters in the nation's capital and its offices in Oregon and Washington were unable to provide any details of the reported lab analysis. The Atlas describes Bigfoot based on the alleged sightings this way, an ape-like creature 8 to 12 feet in height, weighing about around 1,000 pounds, covered in long hair apart from the face and palms of the hands and feet. The footprints are up to 25 inches in length and 5 to 10 inches wide. Bigfoot is very agile and powerful. Major Fred Shirley, an Army spokesman at the Pentagon, said, quote, this is the first time there has ever been any official Army reference to the actual existence of Bigfoot. As far as we know, no other government agency has recognized its possible existence before. We believe the Army is the first agency to do it, end quote. The Army's action was encouraging news to Dr. Jeffrey Bourne, director of the prestigious Yerkes Regional Primate Research Center of Emory University in Atlanta. I believe that Bigfoot could be a Gigantopithecus that was known to exist about 750,000 years ago and looks like a part ape, part man, he told the Inquirer. Bigfoot has been sighted hundreds of times, according to Professor Grover Krantz, a University of Washington anthropologist, and Ron Olson, executive director of the North American Wildlife Research Association, who have studied casts of the animal's massive footprints. Professor Kant said he hoped the Army would now lend its support to an all-out effort to capture one of the creatures for scientific study. Olson said his organization has fed reported sightings of the creature into a computer to trace a pattern of movements. With help and a bit of luck, I feel we could catch Bigfoot in 2 years, he declared. Whether or not it was actually caught, that's another matter. So, interesting about these events in 1975 between the Atlas, newspaper articles regarding it, and all of these things. So I guess this would bring us to the next question. Why would the U.S. government want to keep Sasquatch a secret? What do you guys think?
I mean, they released it themselves, right?
What do you mean?
1975, that was released, and then...
What? Well, that was only the department that those specific engineers. So if they didn't get the memo, or the memo was made after that because they don't want the information out there, Didn't you get that memo?
Yeah.
I don't.
That was the only mention of it, though, right? Like ever.
At that time, I'm not sure. That's what I could find. Other than that, I mean, there have been a couple of suggestions and hints that we'll get into in a little bit, but just for the moment. Why do you think, do we have any thoughts on why the government would want to keep it a secret?
The only thing that can come up is the genetic weapon.
That we talked about in a previous podcast?
That's the
is
only
Bigfoot
thing,
a genetic experiment?
Well, that's the only thing that comes up. I mean, if it's a part of nature, I can't imagine, I don't know the incentive or the motivation for a government.
What if it's a highly advanced species that wants to take over and they were hunted to extinction?
Hmm. Yeah, but what?
Maybe they're from Hollow Earth that could reveal all the extraterrestrial secrets.
Ah, okay, okay. Well, I like that, but that's a cool book.
Gotta listen to my Hollow Earth podcast. Yeah. Bigfoot might come from Hollow Earth. If it does, then it reveals too many secrets. They gotta keep it on the down low, right? Johnny.
Okay, well, those are good points. Now I can see how. I mean, at least some theories, you know.
Here's a good article I found that actually goes over a good amount of reasons. This was posted September 21st, 2016 by a Tammy. The name of the article is Why Government Officials Want to Keep Bigfoot Sasquatch a Secret. I was browsing around catching up on my reading when I came across a couple of questions that were asked. Does Bigfoot exist? Why would the government officials want to keep the discovery of Bigfoot a secret? This got me thinking. I broke out my bag of sunflower seeds, snagged a cup of coffee laced with a heavy dose of cream and sugar, and set about working on my theory of, does Bigfoot exist? Why do I think it is such a secret? I dusted off my folders, notes, and dug around the net looking for evidence of the possibility of Bigfoot existing. The Bigfoot evidence was there, but it was only a matter if one wanted to believe it or not. I thought I would begin with the accounts of Bigfoot stories. Pitt Lake, British Columbia in Canada. A man claimed to be kidnapped by Bigfoot. In 1924, a trapper by the name of Albert Ostman claimed to have been kidnapped by a large male Bigfoot. He was then taken back to their camp and held for a week before he could escape. He believed he was taken as an unwilling bridegroom for the Bigfoot's daughter.
Too much LSD.
This is just one of many stories where people believed they were kidnapped to be bred with Bigfoot. It is claimed that there is an area in British Columbia where 21 people have disappeared. The Pitt Lake area in southwestern British Columbia is one such area. No one knows for sure if Bigfoot is behind it, but many outdoorsmen avoid the area. A female Bigfoot was used as a sex slave.
Why is she mentioning this stuff?
In 1962, a zoologist named Boris Porshnev heard and studied a story of a hominid named Xana. Xana was a wild woman, a Bigfoot, that was captured in Russia. She died sometime in the 1880s or 1890s and was believed to be buried outside the village of Tekhina in Russia. She was taken to a village where she was held captive until she became tame enough to do simple chores like a slave. She never learned to talk, only making inarticulate sounds and mutterings. She was described as 6.5 feet tall, having black skin with her body being covered in reddish black hair. After being mated with many of the village men, she gave birth to 4 children, 2 males, 2 females, that lived. The villagers took the infants to raise them when they realized that her previous children had died because she washed them in ice-cold water from the stream. Since her remains couldn't be found, permission was given to exhume the remains of Xana's youngest son, Quit, which were dug up and studied by Igor Bortsev. Reports of the study were published in 1987.
I heard of these people that...
Are you going to bring that up? Sorry. Are you going to write... Did you dig it up or...
Do you want to look at that?
Yeah, that'll be awesome.
Did you hear about these people? They just have hair all over their body?
Yeah, medical condition.
Yeah, it's called hypertrichosis.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
So, I mean, that sounds like it could be that woman.
Oh, I wonder if that's like a Russian one.
Maybe.
Huh.
Because that could explain... I mean, you got a 6-foot person... With that disease, a bunch of hair on their body. Oh, it's a Bigfoot.
Hmm.
I think it's called hypertrichosis.
So this particular Bigfoot has...
This is an article...
I mean, you can see the dark skin and just kind of reddish hair.
This is an article from Exemplar.com. The story of Xana, the Russian Neanderthal, found in 1850. The year is 1850. The place is the Ochamchir region of Georgia in Russia. A group of local hunters are prowling through the forests in search of whatever they can find. What they do eventually find shakes their beliefs to their foundation and leaves the world with an enigma that has yet to be explained. What they saw appeared to be human, and yet not human. It seemed to be young and female with ape-like features. Her arms, legs, and fingers were unusually thick. Her bosom was described as massive, and she was covered with thick, dark hair. She was also said to be absolutely ferocious. Nevertheless, the hunters managed to capture her alive and brought her to the isolated mountain village of Tekhina, 50 miles from Sukhumi, where she was given to a nobleman called Eji Ganaba. Here's a photograph of her.
Hmm. Of the
Xana, the wild
drawing.
Woman. Jeez.
Looks like a photo to me.
Look at this guy.
Can I see that again?
Imagine he's like 8 foot tall walking around. That's a guy. With that disease.
Yeah, but some of these Bigfoot That's interesting how they made a slave
of her instead of, like, I don't know, like killing her as a threat or
so violent and ferocious was she that for the first 3 years of her capture she was kept in a cage where she dug herself a hole to sleep in. The village people were terrified of her rages and would not venture near. Food was thrown to her. Over the course of time she became tamer and eventually domesticated. She was given the name Xana and was moved moved to a wattle enclosure, tethered at first, but was later released and allowed to roam free. But she never wandered far from the place where she was fed. She eventually learned some simple tasks, such as grinding corn and carrying wood, but never mastered a single word of speech, her only utterances being grunts and, if angered, howls. The women of the village remained scared of her. She would be ferocious and bite when angry, and would only come near if she was in a happy mood. Her master, Edgy Ganaba, however, could control her, and she would react with fear if he shouted at her. Xana's wild ways. Xana was immensely strong. It was said that she could outrun a horse. Without apparent effort, she could lift an 80-kilogram sack of flour with one hand and then carry it from the watermill to the village all uphill. She could effortlessly climb trees to retrieve grapes, which she loved. Xana also liked to roam the forest at nighttime, and on warmer days would often rest in chilled pools of water alongside water buffaloes. Xana had an aversion to heat, could not abide being in a heated room, and would tear off any clothing, preferring to walk naked even during the harshest of winters. She developed a fondness for wine and would often drink herself insensible. She had a number of children by a number
drunken
of men.
Bigfoot.
It had been suggested that this was the result of abuse on the many occasions that she had drunk herself into unconsciousness. She always gave birth unassisted, and many of the children did not survive the birth. It has been theorized that this was due to the incompatibility of her genes with the Homo sapien fathers. She is known to have killed at least one of her offspring by her habit of washing the newborns in the freezing river. The babies, obviously not having inherited their mother's tolerance of cold temperatures, succumbed to hypothermia in the frigid waters. Later, offspring were removed from her at birth and fostered with the families in the village. So this is Xana's younger son, Quit, who died in 1954. I guess they took a photograph of him at one point. So he doesn't really look like a Sasquatch. He looks like a regular person, more or less. Xana's children. Among the theories concerning Xana's origins is one that she could be an Almas, a sort of Soviet Bigfoot. There are many anecdotal stories of such creatures having been sighted in the area where she was captured. Another theory put forth by Professor Boris Porchnev of the Moscow Academy of Sciences is that she was actually a member of the remnants of a Neanderthal race that still survives in the mountainous areas of Russia. Xana is said to have died in 1890, and the whereabouts of her skeleton is not known, so a forensic examination of her remains is not possible. However, her children, however, are a different matter. Xana's children were said to be dark-skinned, very strong, and slightly strange-looking, but despite some unusual psychological features, could learn and speak and were regarded as relatively normal. One of her youngest children, her son Quit, whose father, according to rumor, was Edgy Ganaba himself, died in 1954. He was incredibly strong-built and had dark skin, but apart from these two attributes, he seemed to have inherited most of his facial features from his father. Quit's skull was given to anthropologist M.A. Koladieva, who compared it to other typical male skulls from Abkhazia, who found it was significantly different from them. She wrote, "The Tikhina skull exhibits an original combination of modern and ancient features. The facial section of the skull is significantly larger in comparison with the means of the Abkhaz type. All the measurements and indices of the superciliary cranial contour are greater not only than that of the mean Abkhaz series, but also than those of the maximum size of some fossils found studied, or rather were incompatible with the latter. The Tikhina skull approaches closest the Neolithic Vavnig II skulls of the fossil series." So some people think that this was simply a Neanderthal that survived.
That's interesting.
So anyway, so this was a case that she mentioned. So she moves on. So this back to the blog post. Everything you know is wrong. So this is the theory of Lloyd Pye. Do you guys know Lloyd Pye?
No.
So Lloyd Pye has been doing research for years to prove that Bigfoot is part of a hominid family, and that humans are a genetic mutation, a result of alien DNA, a result of alien DNA being spliced together with Bigfoot DNA. Is it a possibility? Yes, there are some that think so. Do we know that to be a fact? Well, we may soon find out once Melba Ketchum finishes her DNA paper she is currently writing on Bigfoot DNA gathered from two bodies and other specimens. We talked about her on numerous podcasts. There's over 100 samples. Then the DNA study was, in fact, peer-reviewed through leaked emails, and then the whole thing was kind of sabotaged. Once again, if there is an active U.S. government conspiracy to cover up Bigfoot, then that is how it would play out, right? In his book called Everything You Know Is Wrong, Lloyd Pye states that he believes there are four types of Bigfoot. the Bigfoot Sasquatch, the Abominable Snowman Yeti, the Alma Captar, and the Agagwe Sedepa. He gives example how Bigfoot could be the Neanderthal man, not just by the shape of his skull, but the position of the limbs and its walk. He claims that they are more suited for this planet than humans. Humans, on the other hand, are very fragile creatures. Our bones are thin, eye sockets small, which makes it hard for humans to see in the dark, and the humans walk unbalanced in uneven terrain. According to Lloyd Pye, there is not a single human bone in the so-called pre-human fossil record. Are we going back into the evolution debate? Maxwell's favorite subject.
Do you want to go to back to that debate? I don't know. I'm not really interested in it. I just want to hear stories of people encountering these Bigfoot people.
More. Okay, so what if? What if the Neanderthal man didn't go extinct as predicted 30,000 years ago, but was simply shoved to live in areas that were unappealing to humans, such as jungles, swamps, or deep woods? This would explain the stories of the upright, hairy, walking humanoids, aka Bigfoot. Remember the stories I posted above? One begs to question, how is it possible for a Bigfoot to mate with a human? Take a look at the genetics of a mule. A mule is produced when a female horse mates with a male donkey. All male mules are born sterile, but occasionally a female mule will have an estrous cycle and therefore can produce an offspring, but nothing can be established with certainty until it is understood how the genes are lined up. The same applies to Bigfoot females mating with male humans or vice versa. More evidence is needed on the hominid genome to compare them with the human genome. Scientists such as Melba Ketchum, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, and the late Dr. Grover Krantz are doing extensive groundbreaking research into this, along with other groups such as the Erickson Project, the Olympian Project, and the BFRO and the NABS, North American Bigfoot Search. Okay, now she goes into Battle Mountain, Bigfoot deaths. A story that stuck in my mind was about a claim of an elaborate cover-up dealing with a Bigfoot that was caught in a fire. It was 1999 at Battle Mountain, Nevada, that one of the largest fires at the time broke out. An anonymous government employee witnessed an injured Bigfoot being captured by the firefighters. Officials were called along with medical personnel. The Bigfoot was tranquilized and treated, then transported to an unknown location believed to be in northern Idaho. All parties involved were told not to talk about the incident, and the story was covered up. The government employee passed on the information to Bigfoot investigators, while a science teacher and acclaimed author, Tom Powell, came forward to state that he believed the story to be true.
Oh, man.
All right, so let's get into the Tom Powell case.
That's so close to the creature, like no photos, nothing. Like,
what do you mean?
Like of that incident.
Well, how would you get photos?
I don't know. Just someone had cameras. I don't know. Oh, wait, what year was it?
1999.
Yeah, there's news reports and whatnot. Like there could be.
No, but if this was the whole thing is if this was covered up and treated as top secret.
Oh yeah, after the fact, yeah, they could have confiscated everything, right?
Well, let's look into the account. So this was
sucks.
On August 6th, 1999, Battle Mountain, Nevada exploded into several simultaneous range fires in what would be known as the Battle Mountain Complex Fire. A Bigfoot was supposedly injured in the fire, according to an anonymous government employee who alerted the Bigfoot Field Research Organization, the BFRO. In a letter to BFRO dated August 7th, 1999, the anonymous government employee states, "I observed an animal wounded by fire moving on all fours, not like a bear, more like an ape. Firefighters captured animal, contacted local vet and medical doctor. U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Interior, and Bureau of Land Management on the scene. Animal tranquilized and moved to unknown location. Those at the scene told not to talk about what they saw. Animal approximately 7.5 feet long, tall, human-like arms and legs, face not like man or ape, but mixed between. Hair covering most of body except chest. Chest has hair, but sparse. Hands with sparse hair, palms bare, with 5 digits, with human opposition of thumb and 5th digit. multiple burns, speech, attempted to communicate with caregivers once it realized they were attempting to care for it, multiple burns on hands, feet, legs, and bodies, some second and third degree burn, using rule of nines, approximately 45% of body with burns. Doctor and vet working together, providing care, and moved it to unknown location locally. This notice given in violation of orders by BLM, DOI, and DFNW. Witnesses numbered in the area of 30 to 25. Word is out in the government agencies and among the firefighters since an MD was called out. Many thought a firefighter was injured. Please note that I am a government employee of one of the listed agencies fighting fire in wilderness area of Nevada. Large-scale fire, approximately 70,000 acres burned, and under orders not to disclose information. Protected area. I believe a cover-up is in the making. People need to know. The animal needs to be kept alive and studied and released in protected area. The BFRO didn't know what to believe, and on top of that, they have been unable to verify that there had been a fire in the Battle Mountain area. Tom Powell, late Monday, August 9th, I was finally able to determine from Forest Service sources that there was most certainly a large range fire in this area of Nevada. The Battle Mountain Complex fire had extended to 180,000 acres by Monday and had 610 personnel fighting it at that time. Nothing else was heard from their witness despite email attempts to reach him. Then, some 10 days after the initial report, the witness contacted their BFRO investigator by phone. Here is parts of the report that the investigator prepared after speaking with the witness. Strict anonymity. Much to my surprise, tonight at about 9 p.m., the reporting party of the Battle Mountain incident called me. I talked with the gentleman for about 70 minutes. Although he is maintaining strict anonymity, I was able to put together a bit of a profile of the individual. This fellow, whom I will give the pseudonym Marty, is a male full-time worker for a federal agency. Currently, he is involved in the joint firefighting efforts in Nevada. He has extensive EMT training and experience. He says that until this incident, he had seen it all in firefighting. And these days, he stays mostly in the truck manning the radio. He is friendly but not effusive. He is intelligent, likable, and fairly observant, but he isn't outstandingly articulate. He is a matter-of-fact, low-key, seen-it-all kind of character. Very tired. His regular duties may be in personnel, as he mentioned, that tomorrow he would be seeing the MD involved in the incident about other matters regarding firefighting crews. It was obvious during a conversation that he was very tired. Our talk ended with Marty saying he had to get to bed and get some rest. Approximately 20 people were in the immediate vicinity of the incident. All were debriefed and informed in no uncertain terms that this incident was not to be discussed. There has not been a word about the incident at the BLM fire headquarters. He is very concerned about keeping his job and says he would not look forward to taking a lie detector test. He created an email address exclusively for reporting this incident. Absolute privacy. Although I had originally encouraged him to call me collect, this lengthy call was on him so he can maintain absolute privacy. He is reporting the incident because he believes the information should get out. We agreed in any future communication to use the term patient to describe the Sasquatch. I'll use it here. The incident happened in the early afternoon. About 20 firefighters were directly involved. The injured patient apparently wandered within sight of the fire crew and was then surrounded. The patient seemed to know that he was captured because he soon gave up. Marty mentioned this several times. He just gave up. The patient sat down on his buttocks, giving no evidence of a will to resist. Like a dog gives up and then you can do anything with it. Singed hair. The patient was laid out on the ground at first. His injuries were rather serious, including burns to the hands, feet, legs, and trunk, as well as much singed hair. It didn't take long for medical services to get to the scene. The attending medical team included the regular MD for the fire crews, a vet that Marty didn't recognize, and one or more paramedics. The vet was taken aback at working on a creature so human-like, and he is reported to have allowed the physician to do most of the work. At some point, Demerol and morphine were administered. The patient was placed on a spine board, which was too small. He was then placed on a regular ambulance stretcher. The sides were left down because part of the body hung over too far. The feet hung off the end. Bowel sounds. A cut down was performed to obtain an intravenous line, and fluids were administered. During the treatment of his wounds and the efforts at life support, the patient communicated with moans, groans, and grumbling. Bowel signs were heard by Marty, who was at as close as 3 feet from the patient. No language-like vocalizations were heard. The patient responded to touch, specifically patting and stroking to calm him. You're not going to find an ape or monkey responding the same way. Two or three times, Marty mentioned that the patient was especially responsive to a young Native American woman who started ministering to him right from the very beginning. The patient was removed from the scene in the back of a utility truck, not in an ambulance. Marty said an ambulance would have alerted townsfolk and possibly news reporters, thinking that a firefighter had been injured. No one would follow a nondescript van. The total time from initial sighting to extraction was estimated at 3 hours. Blood leaking. There was no urination, defecation, or vomit at the scene. The patient did not eat anything during that time. Serum and blood were leaking from the burned areas of the body. The area of the arm on which the cutdown was performed was shaved. The hair probably fell to the ground. There was significant blood from the cutdown site and from the subsequent insertion of a venous line, and some of that blood dripped to the ground. No one knows where the patient was taken. No video cameras were on the scene to film any aspect of the incident. The fire commander was present. He had a camera, and he did record what he saw. The patient is described as being about 7 feet tall, give or take a few inches. Marty does not give a weight estimate. Equine odor. Most of the body is covered by brownish hair about 2 inches in length. No gray hairs are evident. There are no mats noted on the coat. There is an odor about the patient. It is not an especially obnoxious odor. Marty calls it a natural odor, but he had a hard time describing it. He said it is similar to a strong equine odor. The head is not sloped. The forehead is heavy boned, the lips large but human-like, the ears human-like and tight to the head, with the earlobe attached, not dangling. The patient is strong-jawed. He could not remember the color of the eyes, but thought they might be brown. The head is about 2 times the size of a human head. There is hair on the face, but not on the palms or soles of the feet. Great bulk. There is great bulk to the patient, but there is no fat. He said his observation of the form of the body did not match with that film with the one running into the woods. And he called that film a probable hoax. He's talking about the Patterson-Gimlin footage. The hands are about 1.5 times a human hand, 5 fingers with an opposable thumb. The fingernails are thicker and heavier, and one was chipped. The feet are large, five toes on each foot. No evidence of fractures, injuries, arthritis, or deformation. He felt he was in the presence of a very human creature. Access to the area. I have asked him to return to the scene and search for the hair from the shaved arm or even the blood that dripped on the ground. He said he has access to the area but probably won't be able to return until the fires are controlled. In response to Doug's plea that someone return to the site and search for blood and hair evidence, Marty reported back to him on September 26. Dozer has torn up the area. Nothing left. Word is there is still life. Location unknown. Believe within a couple hundred miles. Later, Marty. Tom Powell. Doug concluded that the dozer work seemed a bit too convenient and was likely a cover story concocted by Marty to explain away his inability to recover any physical evidence. Doug strongly suspected that the whole matter was a hoax on the basis, and that is where the situation pretty much ended. Precise detail. But Tom Powell couldn't leave the case that easily, and further on continues. It is my feeling that this person, Marty, was not lying, and that this set of described events really did happen. There is simply too much precise detail and a complete absence of error or contradiction. The report was dismissed as a probable hoax and never posted for public inspection at the BFRO website, where it might have been seen by someone else who was present at the time and who might have contacted BFRO to confirm or deny the account. 3 years after the event, Tom Powell dug up the old files on Battle Mountain and decided to try and send Marty an email message and see what happened. Less than 24 hours, he was surprised to receive this reply. Not disclosed. Tom, I had almost forgotten about the event until now. Have not spoken due to that classification that was put on it. The patient was taken to a university or some hospital that was not disclosed. As for verification, well, other than my contact with you, I know of no one other than those there on the scene. An affidavit was signed under the Department of Interior and U.S. Forest Service as one, confidential under penalty of felony arrest and jail time, two, immediate loss of government service rank, loss of retirement and benefits. Several meetings were held in reference to, quote, him. I do respect his rights to life and will always be a believer of their existence beyond any shadow of a doubt, as seen with my own eyes, smelled with my own nose, and heard with my own ears. Native man. His image is still visible as it was then. No monster, no animal, but a lineage of native man. His trust in us to take care of him and recognize him, that harm was not meant when contact was made, knowing that care would be given to him. I am sure that Department of Interior knows where he may have been released. What more can I say? Specific features, anatomy, will stand in front of the mirror and think of man's evolution. Tom Powell. I am left with two inescapable conclusions. First, Bigfoots do exist, and second, the government does not want us to know it. The big question that remains in my mind is why? Okay, so he can think of several reasons why secrecy might be imposed. Why the big secrets? Is it that the American government believes that the people of North America are so unstable that they could not deal with knowledge that Sasquatch really exists? Maxwell, you think the American people are that unstable?
They could be.
Government paternalism. It is felt by decision makers and government agencies that the public is somehow not ready to accept the stunning fact that Bigfoot-style creatures exist and at least one species of primates is comfortably ensconced in the forests of North America. Perhaps the justification for this arrogant position is derived from the Christian paradigm that humans are the sole heirs to the planet. The acknowledgement of another species so close to our own, even superior in terms of some sensory capabilities, would destabilize the Christian paradigm that currently dominates Western religious thoughts. Also, to keep mysteries classified, perhaps the government entities that we trust as protectors are really just as baffled by this matter as anyone. As with the UFO phenomenon, the knee-jerk reaction to government when confronted with a genuine and profound mystery is to classify the entire matter as a secret. This avoids the uncomfortable alternative of having to stand up and acknowledge that the people we pay to understand threats and protect us from them have no real idea what is going on in this particular realm. There is an axiom that may exist within government that boils down to, if we don't understand something, keep it a secret. That way, no one will ever ask us to explain it. How plausible do you think that is? Plausible, not plausible? The government doesn't want to explain things, so they just classify it. What do you think? Nothing? Is this a podcast or what? Government doesn't want to explain something. Is that a good reason to classify it?
What do you think, Johnny?
Yeah, like if they want a secret and they don't want anybody to know about it, then yeah, they would classify it, right?
Well, he was just saying that they were kind of just, if they're that puzzled by its existence, they don't have any answers, so it's easier just to classify it instead of saying it's true. Kind of like with UFOs. Like, if they don't know what UFOs are, whether they're dangerous or not, how can they say, oh, UFOs exist, and then the public panics?
But there are classified documents about Bigfoot? They have that?
Well, how would we know if they're classified?
Well, like redacted files or something. You got to do a Freedom of Information Act.
I believe there are. We have to do a podcast.
Yeah, the Atlas has it. It's right in there. It says they're endangered.
Yeah. So anyway, back to this Tammy article for different reasons why the government might cover up Bigfoot. So that was the fire incident at Battle Mountain, 1999. So she goes on to say this: anyone following the Bigfoot news recently has been watching to see what will become of the two Bigfoot that were killed by a well-known game hunter. Speculations have been made as to who has control over the bodies and the way they are hid. There was even a claim as to how much the Bigfoot steaks would be worth. In one report, I saw a sales price of $10,000.
Steaks? Like food?
Yeah. Bigfoot steak. It's messed up. I think most of those Bigfoot bodies were hoaxes, though.
He was willing to sell them as sell food, like Bigfoot.
Who said it was willing?
No.
They were just speculating on the price of steaks.
I missed it.
Gotcha.
They were just speculating on what the price of the steak would be.
Ah, okay.
Bigfoot burger?
Yeah, there's a lot of weirdness with Bigfoot bodies. We're going to have to do a dedicated podcast on that. But most of them seem to be hoaxes. There was one, just a quick teaser, that seemed legit, and then they pretended it was a hoax, I guess, to write it off. It was really, really strange. But that's not what this podcast is about. So Although Melba Ketchum was supposedly also given one for DNA analysis. Okay, to say that I was a bit floored would be an understatement. There have been rumors circulating that the parties involved will be coming out with undisputed physical proof that Bigfoot exists, along with a documentary of habitation site where clear footage of Bigfoot were taken. I will post more information on this in the following month or so. Why? So this brings me back to the haunting question. Why the cover-up? To admit that Bigfoot was real would be admitting that science was wrong. There would be a lot of time and money invested in rewriting history books, documentaries, and other historical documents. Documents such as newspaper reports, field reports, police reports that have been published, then pulled from the public about Bigfoot, will need to be resubmitted as evidence as a further admittance of Bigfoot's existence. The Battle Mountain Fire would be one of many cases that had a noticeable cover-up where evidence was hid from the public. If the evidence of Bigfoot was miscategorized, there would be a need to go back and restudy that evidence to be properly categorized, reports rewritten, and a new placement in the system. That alone would be a financial strain on all parties involved, which may result in a further cover-up to avoid the time-consuming and expensive task. To show and admit proof of Bigfoot would involve reprogramming the way society thinks and reacts to this species. There are many states that are passing laws to protect anyone from harming or shooting a Bigfoot. Many in society do not realize how often and how many species of Bigfoot are killed since this information isn't publicized. I don't know where she's getting information from. I will post a link below on further proof of these killings. One report states that as many as 32 Bigfoot have been killed over the last 125 years. It is believed that there has been a possible government cover-up on some of these incidences since 1968. What, if any, industries would be affected by the publicity and physical proof of Bigfoot? The logging industry would feel threatened because they may face the possibilities of being shut down to further protect the Bigfoot environment. This would create a loss for jobs, resources we depend upon, and revenue from those resources. It would have an impact on people that hunt, fish, and camp in Bigfoot's environment. This may become a new challenge for those parties that enjoy big game hunting and see this as another trophy to mount. Others will feel the need to place Bigfoot on an endangered species list. Parties camping or fishing with young children may feel threatened by the idea of Bigfoot kidnapping them. Lastly, outdoor sports such as skiing, snowmobiling, and snowboarding will be affected. It's like in Ski Free where the Yeti comes to kill you at the end. You ever play that game? That's an old school game. The loss of revenue alone from shutting down such games would leave a huge impact on society's wallet. In a nutshell, it boils down to this. The cost and impact of Bigfoot being alive and living next to us is enormous. Who wants to foot that bill? To Bigfoot that bill?
Who wrote that? What was that? What
it's just a blog.
Oh, okay.
From someone known as Tommy.
Those were interesting reasons.
Yes, I thought so too.
Yeah, so that was interesting because all I thought about was, you know, the genetic weapon.
So, well, what do we think? So, what do we think of the Battle Mountain encounter, though, where they treated a Bigfoot medically and then took it to university? So, did they kidnap it, took it to university for study, or did they release it back into the wild? It seems doubtful that they would release it back into the wild, right? Because that's not really how the U.S. government operates.
I guess they would cage it. I mean, did it survive? Or I don't remember.
Supposedly.
We don't know if it did or not.
It was medically treated.
40% burns on its body.
Yeah, they wouldn't have killed it. Well, at least I don't think.
They were trying to save it, so.
Yeah, they were trying to save it.
So they probably caged it in some... Maybe not caged it, but...
Maybe
like,
it's still alive. What are the lifespans on these things?
Nobody really knows.
Could still be alive. Go take a visit there. He said it went to a university or hospital, right?
Yeah. He said hospital, university. Do we think that's a credible account? It was definitely wasn't the quick, it wasn't the usual super quick hoax type. Like he went
and
into
he,
it pretty
And he was and he a government was a, worker, right?
He said he would, yeah.
How many was interviewed for that?
Well, nobody knows who he was, right?
The one guy.
Oh, it was just one dude? Oh, okay.
Nobody knows who he was though, right? He just made up a fake email.
And he made up an email just for this, but he said he also talked to the guy on the phone for 70 minutes.
Okay.
Did he record it?
Did he record it?
Did he record the interview? We don't know. Possibly. What difference would that make, though?
I don't know. Just to listen to what he sounded like.
Oh, he definitely didn't release the recording because the guy wanted to remain anonymous.
Yeah.
Let's look at one other case from a U.S. Special Forces operative. So this was a mission back in the early 90s. So this is just a letter from an anonymous man. This was sent to Dave Schrader. In the early 90s, I was with the teams in the Navy. We were sanctioned by an alphabet government agency to put a stop to several aggressive Sasquatch in the high country in western North Carolina. We all thought it was a joke at the mission briefing, but it was no joke. My partner in our team of 12 was my swim buddy. He was Native American. This man wasn't scared of anything. Before we were ordered to go out during the briefing, all of these agents were showing us slides of what these creatures did to people, adults and children alike, as well as the damage done to vehicles and homes. Anyway, my buddy turned white with sheer fear. He told me this is bad, really bad. When we arrived in the little mountain village town, the sheriff met us. He told us that he'd never been so happy to see the cavalry since he'd been in Korea. He showed us the actual places where, as he put, this is where those expletives, those big hairy demons destroyed this, or killed him, her, or them there. My buddy was taking everything in like I never saw him before. After talking with the sheriff, our lieutenant told us to fire up because we're going hunting. As we were getting our gear ready, my buddy said to me, "You know, I always thought my grandfather was just telling me scary stories about he and his brothers when they fought the wild men." We started in around 1400. By 1600, we found lots and lots of tracks. We started tracking them. We made out at least 7 different individuals. We made first contact at around 1930, and it was almost dark. The man stopped dead in his tracks and spoke into his headset. "I see one. It's expletive huge." The lieutenant said, "If you have the shot, take it." He shot this massive hairy beast with a 7.62mm round, and it acted like a mosquito bit him. This creature turned around and let out with a god-awful roar. Our point man quickly switched to full auto. This time, the creature dropped like a rock after 10 7.62mm rounds cut up his chest. After first contact, the agents radioed in and they said they wanted one alive. Our lieutenant told them to go screw themselves. It took 3 days and nights with almost no sleep, but we dropped 7 hairy bastards. We found the missing people, or rather what was left of them. We had one casualty when a team member was snatched straight up into a tree. There was nothing anyone could have done for him. To this day, thinking of those 3 days sends chills down my spine. You won't find those 3 days in any military record or mission log. Going into our mission debriefing, where normally we are asked 1,001 questions about every shot fired, every angle we fired from, every angle we fired on, etc., we were simply told that the past 3 days we were doing rigorous mountain training, and during that training period we lost a man. And with that, the debriefing team stood up and walked out. Now, normally we have individual debriefing for the whole team, but this was the one and only time it was just team. So to answer your next question, after 3 days, government agents came in and removed all 7 corpses and flew them out. So this is one of the rare instances where a human was alleged to be killed by a Bigfoot.
Taken.
Snatched into the tree, lost a man. You're saying he could still be alive?
Could be his husband.
Interesting
though.
Point, but they did show a bunch of bodies that were supposedly mutilated by Bigfoot. So, what?
That's crazy.
Tore up his chest.
And yeah, they don't react to it. You need to put a lot of bullets.
Mosquito bites.
Gigantic rounds.
Should have put it to the face, not the chest.
You know how hard it is to hit a head?
That big Bigfoot head.
Don't you do shooting? Yeah, I guess the Bigfoot would have a bigger head.
These are special forces.
All right, there's another incident. We mentioned this briefly, Maxwell, the Mount St. Helens eruption, after which Bigfoot bodies were recovered. Do you know about this, Johnny?
I briefly saw it.
Where?
When I was looking up Bigfoot stuff. There's a battle up there.
So at one of Ray Crow's Western Bigfoot meetings, someone brought up the topic of corpses of Sasquatch after the May 18th, 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. The witness heard of 2 Sasquatch the Army Corps of Engineers had taken out of the volcanic devastation 2 months after the initial blast. Terry Reams heard of a dredging operation of the Cowlitz River and 2 bodies were found in the sand. Is this the same case? a chopper flew them off. Joe Bielart offered that the crane doing the dredging was from the Manitowaka Company and that the bodies were found 2 weeks after the Mount St. Helens blast of May 18, 1980. He suggested that somebody might want to track down the company and find out who was working the shift that the bodies had been found on. During a tour of the devastation by helicopter in 1985, the Viet veteran Hello pilot mentioned a similar tale to Bobby Short, saying there were military halos that choppered out nets full of burned and semi-burned elk, deer, bear, and something with hairy, charred arms hanging out of the drop nets. They were taken to a common pit where the bodies were burned to avoid disease and contamination of the rivers. So there is a report submitted to the BFRO. Fred Bradshaw report concerning dead Bigfoot bodies near Mount St. Helens. My father worked for Weyerhaeuser Company at Green Mountain, Washington, east of Vancouver. The site has security on their roads to check on the equipment and check closed areas to keep people out. My father was working the day St. Helens blew up. He was at a meeting in Kelso, Washington, as he was a supervisor, when Mount St. Helens blew its side out, all heck cut loose. My father was sent back to Green Mountain right away, but like most, he wasn't allowed to go very far because of the mudslide coming down the river. He did get to the town of Toutle, Washington, on Highway 504 off I-5. He and his crew were placed at different spots to watch mud flow and, of course, help people out of the blast zone after the major blow-up. He was sent to the area of Spirit Lake to help keep people out. When the second major blow of the mountain came, my father and the other guy with him reported in and they got out of there. He was then placed in charge of the helicopter landing zone. It was his job to help keep people out of the landing zone and let aid crews in so they could care for injured. Later, when all the people were out and bodies out, the National Guard was brought in to clean up. They hauled dead animals out that they placed in piles, deer in one, elk in another, and so on. They were covered up with tarps and later burned. But my father was placed in charge of one pile of dead that was covered and no one was allowed to go near. Armed U.S. National Guard personnel were around this pile. And one day, when they were going to move this group of bodies, and my father was very close to it and was told to keep his mouth closed. And when the tarps were removed, he saw the creatures, some badly burned and some not. They placed them in the net and lifted them into a truck and covered it over. My father asked a guardsman, what will they do with them? And he said, study them or whatever. He didn't want to know. He said, it's like the other things you don't ask. And off they went, and no one knows what happened to them. My father and the rest were debriefed and sent home. So after this post, here's a comment. I was reading some of the stories about Mount St. Helen on the message boards and wanted to share this one. I only ask that you withhold my name. I was a National Guardsman at the Mount St. Helens site, and this is the first time I have ever spoken about what I saw firsthand. I lived in Spokane, Washington, and was 24 at the time all this took place. I have read some of the other stories, and they only tell part of the story. I was placed on a special cleanup crew further up the mountain. A large tent was set up, and it was to be guarded by armed soldiers who were not part of the guard. There were numerous soldiers on the scene that were not members of the guard. We were given a briefing by a soldier who said that after he spoke to us, we would forget about him and what he said at the end of the mission. This was strange as we had never dealt with anything before. Myself and four other guardsmen were told to follow a group of soldiers and not to speak to each other and to remain very quiet overall. We were told to get into a jeep and wait. We sat in the jeep for maybe a half hour. Eventually, another jeep arrived carrying a civilian and another member of the military. The civilian was brought into the tent, and he emerged a few minutes later, followed by a large, hairy creature. It looked like a large man covered in fur, and the best way to describe it was like Beast from X-Men, only brown. The creature looked to have some burns and a bandage on its arm. At first, we were afraid, but when it walked by, we could see its eyes, and it just looked very sad and somber. He climbed into the back of a pickup truck with the civilian, and the two were speaking in a weird language I had never heard. It would cough at times. We followed the truck to different areas. There were five total stops. Each time we stopped, we were told to follow the civilian and the creature. Each time we followed them to rocky areas where there were caves. The creature would make a sound and then listen. At the first area, he made a sound, and we all just waited in silence. After a few minutes, the creature looked at the civilian and then at the ground. The civilian at one point touched its shoulder and called for a canteen to give the creature a drink. The same thing happened at the next area, but this time there was a response to the sound. After a few minutes, two soldiers emerged from the cave carrying a badly burned creature just like the one with the civilian. The creature bent down next to it and looked it over for about 5 minutes. It then spoke softly with the civilian. It turned and walked back to the truck, and we were told to follow. As we were walking away, we heard a shot, and we knew it was one of the soldiers putting the creature out of its misery. There was no response at the third and fourth site, but at the fifth, there was another return sound to the creature. This time it was different, and soldiers carry out a creature with a badly burned left leg. We were then ordered to all help get a very large stretcher from the truck and to help place the creature on it and carry it back to the truck. We then immediately returned to the base camp. The creature was carried into the tent while the other creature and the civilian spoke. We were ordered to stay in the Jeep until we were to be debriefed. As the creature turned to walk into the tent, it looked at us and made a waving gesture with its hand. We took it as a thank you for what we had done. By the time we were ordered out of the Jeep, we were all in shock. We were called over to an area to be debriefed, and it was just strange. I will never forget what was said because it was just not what was expected. I thought I would hear, "You took an oath now, and you need to live up to it for your country," with a threat also implied. A different high-ranking soldier just said, "Look, do you really all want an explanation? You saw what we were doing. These creatures live in these areas. They mean no harm and want to be left alone. Do you really want to do anything that may cause them trouble? They are like us in a lot of ways. If you need or want to talk about this, just wait about 30 years. By that time, there will likely be no reason to keep them a secret." Well, it's been more than 30 years. I guess there's still a secret.
Wait, why wouldn't there be? Because the depopulation, or, I mean...
I think he's insinuating that they would...
They would populate, or I don't...
That it would be declassified by that point.
Oh, I was thinking, okay, got it.
That's my impression, unless he's saying they would all be died out. My impression is he thinks that it'll be
I was thinking either died out or they increase.
Or maybe he meant both one way or another. Yeah. There'll be no reason. But we were then ordered back to the guard base camp because they were breaking it up so nobody saw too much and knew everything that happened. We did not speak of it. And after a few months, I just took the attitude that these things live out there. And honestly, my life is no different because of it. I only bring it up now because people have been writing a lot about Mount St. Helens. And I believe the whole story should be told. I will also say this. I like to camp and hike and have done so many times throughout the Northwest. Every time I would look for signs of these creatures, tracks, listen for sound, etc., I never saw or heard anything other than what I did that day on Mount St. Helens. Then, later, the following comment was posted. I don't know who wrote this story or if they were there, but I can add this much and I will give you facts that you can check up on if you feel this is a hoax. But I was an airman in the Air Force in 1980. I was stationed at George AFB from the late 70s to the early 80s. Our mission was the Wild Weasels, or Air Force F-4s, that would go into a war area before it started, like the first Gulf War, at low level and pop up and then light up the ground to air defenses and then shoot anti-radiation missiles at the sites letting the other aircraft get in. In 1980, we were shipped to train with the Canadian forces at Comox CFB on Vancouver Island. We took a C-141 from George to Canada. Our C-141 had an in-flight emergency and had to land at Travis Air Force Base in Northern California for repair. We were losing hydraulic fluid in one engine, and I saw the crewman come back and dump several cans of hydraulic fluid into the reservoir, and it just went back to zero. He had a parachute, and we didn't. Kind of made me nervous. But we later got back on our way and flew over St. Helens right after it blew its top. Once we got to Comox, our officer in charge told us we would be there for longer than the two-week TDY due to an emergency mission that they needed help on. We were all specialized airmen trained in different specialties in aircraft maintenance and repair, but we were soldiers first, and we did lots of other stuff that our country needed. We were there for a couple days not doing anything because, as I look back, they were trying to figure out how to use us. Then we all got on a bus and were bused to the area around the south end of the island and were picked up on a strange naval ferry. I was never in the Navy, so I don't know anything about boats, but our bus was tied down and delivered to U.S. side, and we drove off. It was all under darkness, and it was typically cloudy and raining, and we continued our bus ride to the disaster area. We were given M16s and one mag, which I found fascinating because most Air Force enlisted troops shoot a gun in basic, and you may never see an M16 again. We were also given ill-fitting green helmets marked guard, ill-fitting plain green BDFs, and told to follow orders we were given in the upcoming briefing. In the briefing, we were told we would be guards to special areas and told to check credentials and to only allow people in who had the correct credentials in the military tent areas that were set up what looked to be like the perimeter of the area affected by the eruption. We had no idea where we were at. There were no towns or cities around where we were at, and we arrived where we were, about 30 airmen, completely and totally confused on what was going on. We slept in a tented area that was near where we worked. We had a mess tent next to the tent we were slept, and we didn't leave that area about an acre size for a week or more. Most of us, if not all of us, were guarding areas that people moved in and out of with what looked like victims. The tents were guarded, had a foyer area, and we couldn't see what was behind the second door. It was brightly lit, and you had to go through a couple of partitions to get to the main area of the tent. I assume they were there to prevent peeping into the tents by the guards. It was very infrequent that anyone walk in or out. And we worked 12-hour shifts only at night. We were used to working 12-hour shifts because this was just after the Iranian crisis, and we would go on alert every 3 weeks, work 12-hour shifts flying as many missions as we could, then have an off day, then another alert, then 3 more weeks of 12-hour shifts for 3 more weeks. We were told that if anyone tried to breach our area, to shoot. That never happened or came close to happening. This was funny to me because we were giving one magazine, and I don't know if the bullets were real or not. We were Air Force, not Marines. I know more about a 5-iron than an M16, but nothing ever came up. The only time anyone came up to the area I was guarding only happened after midnight, and it looked to me like a doctor in a white lab coat with either a patient or victim who was wrapped in what looked like overcoats and our night shift navy blue ski caps. You could never see the person who was led into or out of the tents because they had their hands in the coats and they were led into the tent by the arm. I think I was there for 8 to 9 days, and it was the most unusual thing I have ever experienced in the Air Force. Last part, out of those nights on guard, I noticed 2 out of the people that were escorted in were very tall. That's the only thing I noticed were those 2 tall people. I was not in a position to see how tall they were, but it was obvious they were over a whole head higher than the doctor, if that's what they were. Only the escort talked, and they only mentioned their last name and showed their badge. I don't know if they were Army or civilian. The other thing I noticed was that the escorted people were really wide. But I always assumed until now that it was the coats that they were wearing. It was very nippy, and I also assumed we were at some kind of altitude. After that, we were given a debrief that we had helped a lot of people who were victims of the eruption. That's all we were told. Victims. And told we were not to mention this part of our TDY. After our last shift, and I don't know how long that was, but it was longer than a week, we were allowed to sleep then. The next evening, we were allowed to shower. We were only allowed skin baths with washcloths till then. In another tent that was behind the latrine tent and chow tent, we were given back our original Air Force uniforms and put back on the same bus we rode in on and bussed back to the same area under darkness, ferried back to Vancouver Island and then back to Comox CFB, and then we continued our TDYs if nothing happened. We did 2 more weeks of flying sorties with the Canadians, played and drank a ton of Canadian beer, Le Blatz Blue, and flew in our C-141 back to George AFB. It was all a big mystery on what happened then till I read this story, but it seems similar. But they must have really been short on personnel to use a bunch of Air Force kids as guards, or they thought nothing would ever happen. But that's the only time I ever pulled guard duty outside of basic training at San Antonio. So after this was posted in November 2008, an email was received from a man in Southern Washington who stated that he had heard anecdotes from Yakima Native people in reference to the Sasquatch after the Mount St. Helens eruption. The most prominent account was that of a large male that was badly burned but still alive that took refuge in an area east of the devastation near traditional tribal lands. He was told that government agents in military gear captured the Sasquatch and airlifted it to an undisclosed location. I have no way of knowing if this is a true account, but it does seem to suggest that there was an effort made to take advantage of the eruption in order to capture specimens, either dead or alive.
I saw this crazy conspiracy a while back on YouTube.
What?
and it's unrelated to Bigfoot, but now that you're talking about Mount St. Helens and all this, but so the conspiracy was, I think it was something like this. They wanted everybody to leave the area because Mount St. Helens was supposedly about to blow up. So the guy was saying that the bombs were planted on the mountain, so nobody could see that they were planted because everybody had to leave.
Hold on, I gotta get more tinfoil.
So they were everybody was forced to leave, so you couldn't see what was going on the mountain because obviously it's gonna blow up. But the idea was that this guy was saying that they planted bombs on the mountain to make it erupt or blow up from the explosion from the bombs.
Right.
So maybe they were trying to get rid of these Sasquatches.
Oh, but then why were they trying to? Or this was different agencies. So, and then the medical personnel didn't know about it. They were just trying to help them, or that's bizarre. What do we think of this whole account? It's kind of strange because in most hoaxes, you don't have people coming out of the woodwork pretending to be other personnel at the site confirming the account. Because in this case, people saw it online and they were like, oh yeah, I was this, or whatever, my father was there, or this person was there. Oh, we were also guards. And if you notice in that account, they never even saw the Sasquatch. They just said these people were wearing coats. They look like tall and wide. So, I mean, that seems sort of credible, I guess. I don't know. What do you guys think? What do you guys think? Do you think the Mount St. Helens so you kind of open it up even crazier, where if this was an intentional extermination, they were using bombs and they knew they were in the area.
Look at that one. Look at some of that footage of how it explodes. It's just like a landslide. It doesn't even look like it was an eruption.
We'd have to compare it to other eruptions.
Yeah. It exploded different times. They're
actually, that's interesting. On my Mothman podcast, I go over a lot. There was supposedly even a Mothman sighted at the Mount St. Helens eruption.
Oh, he made his way all the way out there?
We got a lot of tinfoil for this episode.
Yeah. I mean, Dogman's only Michigan, right?
Actually, our next Dogman podcast is probably going to be UK Dogman. Man, that's only in Michigan. So yeah, Mount St. Helens, were these Sasquatch really treated, killed, recovered? What do you guys think? Credible or not? I think it's very interesting that there was some corroboration. So if it's a hoax, it probably wasn't one guy, because these accounts are coming from all over the place. National Guardsmen, Air Force,
yeah,
medical personnel.
I think it's possible that it could be true. I don't know. That fire one is still getting to me.
I'm going to read one more article from Robert A. Lindsay. So this possible government conspiracy to cover up Bigfoot's existence. I do not think much of a conspiracy theory, but after studying Bigfoot for a while, I believe that the government is covering up the existence of this creature. This was published April 11, 2011. If one is ever killed or found dead, I would not notify authorities first. I would notify Bigfoot organizations and researchers and try to get them to the area to cart the body off somewhere safe. Interesting point. Otherwise, you might notify the news media as a last resort. I have a sinking feeling that if you notify the cops or feds, you will never see or hear of the body again. I believe that the government has been studying Bigfoots for some time now. We have quite a bit of evidence along those lines. Bigfoot researchers searching in known areas are always running across government researchers of various types. They never admit to what they are up to, but to me it's obvious. They're studying Bigfoot. The military seems to be quite aware of Bigfoot. There are many, many sightings at Fort Pierce, Washington, near Tacoma. In one case, a Bigfoot was shot and blood samples were taken. The soldier who shot him was debriefed by an Air Force doctor who had flown into the base for that purpose. He knew all about Bigfoots and asked the soldier many strange questions. The soldier was then debriefed and ordered not to speak of the incident. Edwards Air Base in the high desert of California has had many sightings, though it seems an odd place for Bigfoot to be. Supposedly, the Bigfoots know they will not be harmed on the base, so they come there. All reports on Bigfoot at EAB are classified. All MP witnesses have asked to be anonymous. MPs started to report sightings to organizations in the 1970s, at the same time as there were many sightings around Lancaster. One MP said that the Bigfoots were regularly sighted at the base, but troops were under strict orders not to harm them. The order was just to observe. EAB has a huge underground tunnel structure, and the Bigfoots keep getting into them. The orders were the same. Observe. The Air Force did not feel that the Bigfoots were dangerous, and the MP reported that officers felt they were just some undiscovered animal. The MP said that the Air Force kept this stuff classified because they did not want to deal with the fuss about it. and the resulting Bigfoot hunters drifting onto the base. In addition, the public might feel that the base could not secure its perimeter. Strangely enough, the MP also said that there was a great deal of UFO activity at the base. Okay. The Air Force was very interested in the UFOs and was quite worried about them. The MP even said that the Air Force referred to them as EBIs, or extra biological entities. The Air Force was not worried about the Bigfoots in part because they felt there was no connection with the Bigfoots and the EBIs. By the way, I do have a podcast, Bigfoot and UFOs. You guys could check that out, where I go into the history of Bigfoot and UFO sightings. Subsequent interviews with five other Edwards Air Base MPs have confirmed the MP's story in all ways. An interview with an MP in the 1990s indicated that Bigfoots were continuing to use the base. One Texas Fish and Wildlife official said that the on-record view of Bigfoot was that they don't exist. Off the record, he said, they're out there. They're all over the place. There are lots of them, and we can't do a damn thing about it. Why would the government wish to cover up Bigfoot's existence? I feel the government is going to cover this up until they can't do so anymore. This guy's got some bold claims. So what do we think about all these military sightings? Nothing? Legit? Not legit? More likely to be legit, you said, Maxwell?
Oh, yeah, because when people come forward, like, their stories, because they come, like, five years later, because they didn't, or 10 years or 20 years, because they didn't.
If they're hoaxers, I mean, they at least put in the military time when they describe the situation. Like, it's like they're not. I mean, some of them had detailed information on which rounds they were using in the gun, so it's not just some random, not knowledgeable person in a basement. At least they're putting, if they're hoaxed, they're at least putting effort into the hoaxes to try to make them seem legitimate. So, final word on the Bigfoot government conspiracy. Is there a conspiracy covering up Bigfoot?
I think the biggest proof that they could exist is that atlas.
You like that atlas?
I think that's the only thing that makes
sense.
It's
pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, I can't believe they printed articles.
A lot of clues. That's almost like a smoking gun.
I think that's the top.
I like the Ketchum DNA study and the leaked peer review emails about the Sasquatch DNA.
That fire one too is kind of interesting. Eh?
Yeah.
And the Mount
St. Helens, because they had some corroborated sources. They had some multiple accounts, multiple claims from the different types of people that were there.
What was the estimated body count of the St. Helens?
I think 7.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's not 1 or 2. Well, yeah, it was 2 to 7, depending on two to seven, something like that. So we hope you enjoyed another episode of the Mind Shock Podcast. If you like our podcast, you can donate to our PayPal. Just check the link in the description and check out all our social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, and also our Patreon. This is Bruce McGuire signing off.
Johnny Mills
and Maxwell Powell.
Catch you guys next time.